America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show this week. Our topic this week is families and money. So please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me say that again, 1-800-313-9443. And today we're going to have an exciting show. First, we have our special commentator, Ms. Megan O'Toole, with us today. Hello, Megan.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Well, obviously, I shouldn't have had that extra cup of coffee. I'm a little jumpy here. Today, our special guest is Ms. Whitney Wogan. Whitney, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michael. And hello, Megan. So great to be here.
Folks, you may recall that Whitney has the website called womenwithmoneymoxie.com, and she is a graduate of Mises University 2009, where she studied Austrian economics, what we like to call reality economics. We had Whitney on the show in August talking about women and money, and today we are going to talk about families and money. Folks, I think Whitney is going to give you some excellent strategies and resources, so please get out a piece of paper. You'll want to take notes. I think this is going to be a really great show. All right, now, Whitney, you know, a lot of couples just don't talk about money. What are some of the ways that you recommend to open up this conversation and make it easier?
Michael, that's such a great question, and I'm so glad you started with it, because it's a subject that's near and dear to my heart, as this was one of the issues that my husband and I had when we were newlyweds and we found ourselves deep in credit card debt. And
that sounds like a common experience to a lot of Americans.
I think, yeah, across the board, as I talk to people, this is a common experience. And that it tends to be even exacerbated by the fact that couples aren't talking about it, so it makes it worse. And so one of the things that, after my husband came to me and said, oh, Whitney, we are heading down a financial cliff here, or over a financial cliff if we don't do something. So after I blamed him, you know, being the responsible person, I immediately blamed him and then realized, oh, the only part in this whole mess that I can control is me, so I better start paying attention to what I'm doing. We started to get a handle on it. And so a spot in a marriage that can be a real sore spot and a real source of anxiety and pain can actually turn into a place of real strength and togetherness for a couple. So if confronted and if dealt with, this is a really powerful, can be a very powerful catalyst in a relationship.
Well, you know, some people just feel that they can't talk to their spouse because perhaps that one person, that other person in the relationship is not interested in finances.
Yeah.
You know, how do you handle this situation?
Yeah, that is a tricky situation, especially since you don't want to step on any toes. But there are a couple of strategies that I talk with couples about. One of them is what we call, you know, just tit for tat, and that's in the best sense of the word. That is, let's say that it's initially it was me that was not interested. So if the wife is someone that's not interested in talking about money, maybe there's some topic that she's interested in. Let's say she's learning about, you know, she's becoming a counselor, or she is interested in, I don't know, collecting antiques or something. Mm. One of the things that I recommend is that the husband take 10 to 15 minutes or a half an hour on the weekends, and they each study what the other is interested in. Mm. So that they learn, they can start finding commonalities in other areas as well as in finances.
Mm-hmm.
And if a couple chooses to do this, and it's been successful, if a couple chooses to do this, I recommend that the husband have the wife, or if it's the husband who doesn't want to talk about money, that you start with a very gentle lead-in to, you know, to talking about money.
Well, this is going to be a rich conversation. We're going to have a lot to talk about here. So, folks, please stay with us. We're going to take a short break. This is Radio Free Market. This is your host, Michael McKay. We're going to be talking about families and money. We're going to be talking about more about this right after we get back. Please stay with us. And we're back. Folks, this is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we have Whitney Wogan, and we're talking about families and money. And we were just talking about, you know, what happens in a relationship When one person in the relationship is not interested in talking about the finances, this is not a show really about relationships per se. This is a show really about money. But since we're talking about money and families, I mean, obviously we're making that bridge now. You can't escape it. How do you get a spouse, your partner, to open up and start talking about money when they're just not interested in it?
Yeah, it's a great topic because it's, as we all know, it is one of the reasons for most distress and divorce in married couples. So if you can start talking about it and can start opening up that area, it can really be a positive thing in a relationship. Another strategy that you can use for that is if you find just small things, like really baby steps. Take this with just baby steps forward. If there's an interesting article, or another strategy that you can use is if you know of another couple that's interested in finances, invite them over for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of friends, and the wife was not at all interested in finances, and the husband very much was. But she would sit, you know, and listen to us, and we didn't overwhelm her with it. But slowly, she started to come into the conversation, and I've noticed over the last few months that she's really started to contribute to the conversation and ask questions, and her husband has remarked how much it has changed. And I'm not trying to say that it's always the wife that's in the situation, because it's not. I know plenty of women whose husband just doesn't want to deal with the finances. So either way, it works.
Well, I know some couples, they actually plan a meeting. They have a meeting either once a week or once every other week. They sit down and they review things. I know other couples that they just talk about things on the fly. And one other strategy that we found useful in our family is that there is a agreed-upon limit on spending before talking about money with one another. So whether that's $50, $200, or whatever, that got us in the habit of checking in. Because checking in is really what we're talking about in terms of getting the conversation started.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you and your husband co-wrote this Getting Control of Your Money, an easy step-by-step workbook that you offer on your website. Isn't working with your spouse difficult?
You know, it used to be, it used to be very difficult. And we had a couple of rules that we set that we were one of those couples that met every week. Every Sunday we would meet. Initially we would meet once a week if it would be in the evenings. And one of the things we noticed is that those meetings we didn't do as well in them. There was more arguing. And what we realized is that we were both too tired.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved the meetings to a time of day when we were both alert and awake.
Mm-hmm.
So our two most important rules in dealing with finances with each other is we don't talk about money when we're tired, and we don't talk about money when we're hungry. And if the subject comes up, and now we have enough practice and we know that one of us is getting grumpy, we'll just check in, you know, have you eaten well, or are you tired? Should we put this off until another time? And that is just that simple thing. Low blood sugar and tiredness really make a difference in the quality of your conversation. So I think that just in and of itself can be really helpful.
You know, we're going to come back to these idiosyncrasies of how to work through relationship issues. I'm sure as we talk about more aspects of money and families and how this whole thing works. But these are strange and actually very difficult times for many families. What's a good defensive strategy to employ until we see some kind of improvement in the economy?
Yeah, that's another great question, because it is a strange time right now with all of the layoffs, and it's just very uncertain. I think that coming back to just one of the most important things, I think, and this is not as much a financial strategy as it is a life strategy, is for a person first to get clear on a place where they feel grounded and connected and at peace. And for some people that may be through their place of worship. For others it might be in nature. For others it might be, you know, so first getting connected up and feeling that you are grounded and hopeful, because hope is a tremendously important thing to have it as you move forward. One of the things that happens, Michael, when people are laid off, or there's a large financial strain, is that people physiologically shut down a little bit. Their field of vision narrows. And it's also something that happens psychologically. So if you can do things to reopen that field of vision, that's really helpful. And one of the things I suggest people do is that they take a resource inventory. And that is an inventory of all of the resources they have in their community, among their friends, in their household, because that will give them a place of, oh, there's more choice here. It'll open their field of vision back out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those things
I think that that's an amazing phenomenon that I've seen happening. Although, you know, there's a downside, and it's definitely bad. I don't think the recession is a good thing. But there's an upside to that. It's that people are turning more to their communities when they're better, not as well off as they were before. And they're not as focused on shopping constantly, shopping till they drop, and they're turning more to either their place of worship or their place of meditation where they find community with other people and with whatever spiritual sources they have. I think that it's a good trend, and people are reexamining the choices that they make with money, and also they are thinking about their relationships and how that money, the relationships are more important than the money, and I think that's a good refocusing.
I love that phrase you used, Whitney, taking inventory, because if we all just take inventory of this moment, you can say, well, I'm fed, I have food in the fridge, I have gas in the tank, I have, you know, a roof over my head, maybe I'm feeling threatened about that being there tomorrow, as some people actually are right now. But taking inventory of where you are right now gives you the personal ability to respond right now with, well, what else do I have? I have mental capacity. I have initiative. There's something more that I can do, as opposed to feeling, you know, paralyzed and fearful.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you can expand that out into the community, I know our libraries are tremendous resources for people with interlibrary loan, bookstores. Mm-hmm. The Small Business Administration has, I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with SCORE, but that's a successful retired business executives that offer free advice through the Small Business Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous resource for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if you can take a moment and breathe and realize, oh, there's a lot more available to me and I have a lot more choice, and this could be potentially a blessing. It's hard to see at the time, but down the road it may lead to something better.
Let's talk about how people can turn things around if they're facing a real difficulty right now. You know, we've heard of many people that are going into foreclosure for lack of, you know, a few hundred dollars a month increase in their mortgage or decrease in their income. How can a family turn that around?
Well, I think one of the first things, obviously, is, and this, for some families, this is just not going to be applicable because they're already really operating on a very narrow margin. But certainly there is, the first thing is pulling what you're spending in. So if you can, you know, disconnect your cable TV and do some simple things like that, get your expenses down to make your monthly nut much smaller. That's the first thing. And the second thing, I think, is trying to figure out how you can create more cash flow. And there's a great book I recommend for people. It's called Put More Cash in Your Pocket by Laurel Langmire. And Langmire,
let's have you repeat that.
Yeah. It is called Put More Cash in Your Pocket by Laurel Langmire. And Laurel is L-O-R-A-L, Langmire. And she talks about strategies where you use what you know, the things you can already do. Maybe it's sewing, maybe it's car repair, maybe it's painting, maybe it's that you can start using some of those resources. And how to get a business up and running in 2 months or less to really get something cranking quick, so that you can start putting more cash in your pocket. Because most foreclosures happen for lack of around $700 a month. And so to create that extra $700 to keep your house with the resources that you already have, the things you already know how to do and how you offer those, She goes into strategies for doing that.
So I know in your writings have listed what you call the three most important things someone should do to protect their money right now. What are those three?
Well, it is, like I said, like you said earlier, Michael, it is a very unusual time. So this is probably different advice than I would have given, 10 years ago. I think the first thing someone should do is look at precious metals. They did very well during the Depression, and they did very well during the 1970s inflation. So whether you think we're heading for inflation or deflation, that is a good hedge. That's one good thing I think a person could do. A second thing is, like I said earlier, is getting control of your expenses. Really got to bring those in. And it really depends on, we need to look across the spectrum here. This is going to be different advice for somebody that has, a steady job, has some savings, feels fairly secure than someone who just got laid off and has no savings.
Mm-hmm.
So for that person, the strategy might be a little different.
We're going to come back to number three in just a minute.
Yeah, sounds good.
But folks, we're going to take a short break. This is Michael McKay, and you're listening to Radio Free Market. And we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Whitney Wogan, Megan O'Toole, our special commentator, and myself. We're talking about families and money. And Whitney was just answering the outline of her points of the three most important things someone should do to protect their money right now. You first listed, look at precious metals. This is, I think, a very fundamentally important thing. We can talk more about that later. Not everybody's going to be able to do that. But, your second point, which you brought up, Whitney, was, getting control of your expenses. And, that, of course, is always an excellent, point. A lot of people are in denial. They don't want to get a control of their expenses, but, they don't look at different strategies to reduce their spending, but there's a lot of different strategies that they can employ.
Absolutely, yeah. It's amazing how much money you can find hidden in your expenses. If you really take a good close look at them, you'll find money in there that you didn't realize that you had that you can pull out of your expenses.
Okay, and your third most important thing?
Well, I think the third most important thing is having a good, solid education about money. What I mean is starting to learn about money and educate yourself. And that means the basics of basic financial skills, which really relates to the second point of, not spending, overspending, but starting to understand what's happening right now with the economy, I think is critical, because we are going through a historic shift right now. And we are woefully unprepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a point when education is going to be extremely important. And I recommended it last time I was on your show, Michael, but I cannot recommend enough Richard Mayberry's book, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. It'll start giving you an idea about what's happening right now in the big picture economy.
Right. We recommend that book on our website, radiofreemarket.com, as one of the foundational books that people should read just to get their basic education process going. And that book, again, is called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, and it's written by Richard Mayberry. This concept of learning about money, I was saying during the break that, growing up, we learned that education was basically oriented around basic literacy, reading, writing, arithmetic. But being uneducated about money is the most important illiteracy that we have to address. And that is really the focus of Radio Free Market's website, this radio show, our conversations. I know your effort, Whitney, with womenwithmoneymoxie.com, that's what you're really trying to alleviate, is this basic illiteracy that we see that is prevalent. It is a vast subject, learning about money, and often seems disconnected from the reality of everyday life when people try to study economics, because so many aspects of what passes for economics is very confusing to people. Besides that one book, where do you really advise people to start?
Well, I think that's and any of Richard Mabry's books are great. I think Mises.org is a great resource for people. That's M-I-S-E-S, M as in Mary, I-S-E-S.org. That's where I met both of you, was at the Ludwig von Mises
mm-hmm.
Institute.
Right.
And they have, their website is just a wealth of resources, many, many books that you can download for free.
I think that's a really strong point that we ought to really emphasize for people, that there's a wealth of education that's available for free.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't have to feel alone. You don't have to feel lost. You can nose around in there, read the daily articles. There's books that are 900 pages long that you can read for free. There are books that are, you know, introductory level that you can read for free.
Yeah, and get on the chat groups on if you are feeling alone in this or confused by it and want to talk to some other people about it. Their chat groups and their blogs are great.
Well, let me ask you this. In a broader sense, is it really necessary, do you think, for people to understand economics, or, you know, can we just get by with just understanding money, you know, how to, you know, write a check and get through your day?
I think we could have back in the 1800s when money was tied to gold and we had a very stable currency,
mm-hmm.
but in the 1900s that changed, and currencies now are subject to government decree, and so I think that what's happened is that our the basics of our economy, the foundation of our economy, which is sound money, is no longer, and I think it's critical, absolutely critical, that people understand that now. So in our modern day world, I think it's critical. What's your experience? Do you think the same thing?
Well, I look at it from the perspective that there's functional knowledge. There's knowledge that gets us through the day, that allows us to just be functional, like driving a car. You don't really need to know how a car operates, mm-hmm. you know, until it breaks down, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this other level of knowledge, which comes in really handy, which I call systemic knowledge, which when the car breaks down, well, you better have more of it. In other words, there is a certain minimum amount of knowledge that we need to have in order to get through. And we'll talk more about that, because it's an interesting idea. We are coming into another break, and this is Radio Free Market. We're going to take a short break. Folks, stay with us, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking about families and money. And we have Whitney Wogan, and she is the owner of the website womenwithmoneymoxie.com, which I recommend highly to everyone, and our special commentator, Megan O'Toole. We were just talking about is it really necessary to understand the basics of economics, and I was bringing out the point that there is a difference between what we call functional knowledge and systemic knowledge. I mean, without getting fancy with these terms, I mean, people all understand that you can get by with just knowing how to operate a car, basically. A couple of basic dance steps will get you through on a date until more complicated music shows up. Or basic math will do you fine until you have to deal with a more complicated situation. And what is the problem for people today is that because of how money is starting not to work, because what we're finding with people losing the purchasing power of their dollar, or in one fell swoop losing 30 or 50% of their portfolio, people are left bewildered. They don't know, why did this happen? They have run right into the end of their functional knowledge, and they need to get educated in a deeper sense in this systemic knowledge. And, you know, we were talking about Austrian economics. People who have been listening to the show have heard the term Keynesian economics. Whitney, I want to throw this to you, but Megan, please chime in. Why does one school of economics say one thing and another say the opposite?
That's a great question, because it's so pertinent right now. I think it really has to do with the starting point of the different schools of economics. The Austrian economists approach the economy as a result of the action of humans, what they're doing. So it's not so much for them a quantitative or mathematical approach to economics. It very much is based on humans act, and they act in their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. And then what can you deduce logically from that point? Other schools of economics come from much more of a physics type of approach or mathematical type of approach and look at large aggregates of information and are spending a lot of time looking at the big flows of money and that type of things. And I think, to make a very broad brushstroke, forgetting that that all economics is based on humans interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm. I like to use the phrase that Austrian economics recognizes that what we have is a human ecology, whereas Keynesian economics basically looks at the economy or the interaction of people as a big machine. And when you look at things as a giant machine, then you naturally think maybe if you pull this lever or adjust this knob, you know, things are going to be different or the way that you think they could be. Mm-hmm. Whereas an ecology recognizes that there is so much that we cannot ever know, that there's a natural, spontaneous order to things, that there are certain principles upon which things operate. And the Austrian economic school, which actually has a much better predictive track record than the Keynesian school to predict these events that we are seeing right now, really looks at this much more holistically and in a much more integrated fashion. And whereas the Keynesian school simply were blindsided by it and even caused it because of the very policies that they promulgated. So,
well, the problem is that Keynes was really not that great of an economist in the first place. I mean, he was just a bureaucrat who wanted to come up with ideas for central planners to control people with. And Mises recognized that economic calculation is not possible in a centrally planned government that's controlled by bureaucrats, where the government confiscates the property of the people and redistributes the wealth and attempts to run the systems that would run on their own perfectly fine in a free market. The government cannot imitate those systems, and they can't predict just how a market will behave because it is always, as Mises said, going towards equilibrium, but it never completely arrives at equilibrium, and you can't know just how to redistribute certain factors of production because they're going to be redistributed by the free market differently than they were in the past. And there's a turnover that occurs in business cycles. The market can't be mimicked by government bureaucrats, and that's what Keynesian economics attempts to do. It's artifice.
What I've used as an example in this kind of a conversation is that what all socialist programs basically screw up are prices. And prices are signals. And if you take signals that are price signals out of the equation, that's like taking language out of the equation of human interaction.
Exactly.
Because if we don't have language that we can use to communicate the choices of this particular moment, of this particular interaction, then how are we going to communicate? And you can't project into the future if you're not allowed to use language as to, you know, how you're going to interact with anybody. Everything basically comes to a standstill. And if you limit language, then you basically make it very complicated for people to communicate. In the same way, when prices are limited, in various ways are manipulated to be limited, then it sets up this aberration of an economy that isn't a free-flowing economy. So
Keynesians have a formula for just about everything, but they don't have a straightforward answer to our spiraling debt problem that people imitate as individuals, that our government has. We keep going to China and urging them to buy more of our debt, you know. It's a very bad sign for us. mm-hmm. as a country.
Now, we had talked earlier about some good resources for people to teach themselves more about money and economics. And, folks, if you're listening here, I would like you to get out your piece of paper and jot down these websites. First, Mises.org. It's M-I-S-E-S.org. And then RadioFreeMarket.com. This is our website. And also WomenWithMoneyMoxie.com. WomenWithMoneyMoxie.com. It's all one word. And Megan has some wonderful resources there for you as well. You know, getting back to the family and money theme of this show, one of the primary reasons couples fight over money, which means their children may observe, what our children are observing around money is tension, fear, and discord. You know, what's a way to create a healthier and environment, a healthier atmosphere in homes around financial issues?
Well, you know, this is a great question because another great question because I asked my daughter, I said, what do you think about this question? And she said, communication, Mom. I think that when we talk about it, it helps me not feel afraid of it. It helps me understand it when it's not. And she's 13, so she mm-hmm. was. She said, when it's not dumbed down, you know, when it's, you know, you don't have to talk over me, but when you talk straight to me about it, I feel like I understand what's going on and I can get a better sense. So I think part of it, communication is the biggest thing. Lots of it, lots, you know, be very clear about it and include your children in the discussion around money appropriate to their age level. That's probably one of the most important things. And certainly if the parents can do a good job of working on it in the context of their relationship, that's going to affect the family, you know, the family fabric.
Mm-hmm. Megan, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I am not married. I don't have children, but you would have to admit that, you know, everybody spends money, and the money dilemma applies to everyone in the economy we're living in right now, including single people. And I do have a roommate. She's from China, and I recently taught her how to budget when she shops at the grocery store, and you just make a budget and you stick to it. It's quite simple. And I've lived as a college student for these past several years. I'm a graduate student now, and it is an art to learn to live off of $800 a month. It is quite an art. And I just think that people need to realize they don't need as much as what they think they need. They just want. And growing up as the second oldest of five kids, I realized that I had to take care of myself, support myself at a very early age, and I've worked a job, and I've seen what it takes from my parents to budget and to make sure that everyone is taken care of, sometimes in a minimalistic way, but in the end, you're glad that you can pay your bills and that you're not entrenched in debt. So I attended a college that actually, College of the Ozarks, that allows you to work for your tuition on campus, and it's a private college in southern Missouri. And now I'm attending a state university as a teacher, and I'm obtaining my master's in English by teaching composition. And that's paying for both my tuition and providing me a small stipend. So single people, don't have to live extravagant lives, and they can support themselves by thinking practically about what they really need and what they really don't need.
Excellent, excellent advice. You know, Whitney, back to the families investing. We were talking about earlier how many people have suffered tremendous financial losses in the last year and a half or so. How should a family address or handle these kinds of losses?
Well, you know, it relates to what Megan was just saying, and I think what we were talking about with trying to make the family environment more conducive and healthy for children learning about money, and that is to bring children in on the budgeting process. That's one step, to start making them to gather together and plan. One of the things we don't tend to do in this culture is we may create a budget, but we don't revisit it on a regular basis, and that's one of the things I talk about. And that my husband and I discovered was that every week we actually looked at what we spent, and then we planned our spending going forward. That forecasting piece is missing. So that's one place where you can start to get control of your finances, and doing that with your family is a tremendously empowering and strengthening activity.
You know, that's a very radical idea to, I think, a lot of listeners, the idea that you sit and talk with your children about money, and particularly about the family money. I know that was never done, you know, as I was growing up. It was basically verboten. And
with my family, yeah.
Yeah. And in other words, you know, I think the process of education about money should be a family effort. What do we know? What don't we know? You know, let's assess our you said earlier, taking an assessment of your, an inventory of your assets. Well, your knowledge assets, your family knowledge assets are very, very important. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to improve your overall family health, financial health, that requires you to also look at your at educating your children about this so that they, in turn, have a good foundation as they go forward.
Absolutely.
So,
and there's
yeah.
a place where I think children, I know with my children, my 13-year-old is very much, she works, she is very interested in getting a job. She's in a part-time program, and she has Thursdays available to her, and she's looking for a job that pays right now. That's really what she wants to do, and it's,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of children want to contribute to the family economy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that I think you can start to bring into bear when your children get older.
Absolutely.
So they can start to contribute.
Well, we had a show a little while back with Art Carden on the myths of capitalism's history, and one of the points that Art brought out is this idea, the myth of the pristine childhood. You know, we've been brought up in a culture that believes that children shouldn't work, whereas the history of the world, if they were old enough to carry something, they were working. And there's a value in children learning how to work and what work means to the contribution of a family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids feel out of sorts that they're not contributing to the family when they get older.
Right. Well, you know, I think this topic that I think we're going to have to bring out more in another show, which I look forward to doing, is how do we prepare children for money, for the process of being a responsible person like you, Megan, who as a young adult had to grapple with the fact that, hey, well, I want to go to college. I don't have the resources for it. How am I going to make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you had to make that happen. And one of my favorite lines is that as a parent, that what I'm doing is I am preparing my children, and I look at them as adults in training. And even from an early age, I have to start inculcating in them some very basic habits of personal responsibility, honesty, truth, and caring for other people and so on like that. So this will be a really great segue as we go forward with this. But let me bring this back for a minute. You know, talking about how many people are suffering from loss of jobs and lack of income from this financial crisis, yet it's often stated, as you mentioned earlier, I believe, Megan, mm-hmm. that many millionaires were made during the Great Depression, many more than at any other time. What strategic moves would you make going forward to create income and security, Whitney, for a family, knowing that there are tough times, but there are strategic things that we can do right now?
Well, I think that if just knowing that at times like this, that there's opportunity. I think approaching it as this is a time where there is tremendous opportunity. People are looking for, it's a place, a time where you can really help. If you have a product or something on the market that is, you create something or you create a product that people need, it's a great time to be selling that, or that if you can, and that people need. Another strategic move, I think, and this is really where Laurel's book comes back in, is to start diversifying your sources of income. We have been brought up to think that we just need the job and the job is going to do it for us and that that's what's going to take care of us and we just have to do well at our job. But I think this climate requires a different way of looking at your finances and thinking about money And in this way, I think diversification of your income is a good idea. So trying to figure out where can you make that extra few hundred dollars a month, $1,000 a month. Is it on Saturdays, you know, with a lawn mowing business? Is it painting? Is it offering painting services? You know, those kinds of things. I think really getting back to the entrepreneurial roots of this country, you know, that it's starting to really, and not expecting that the government is going to do it for you, not expecting that, you know, Social Security is going to be there in the future, because as we know, it's really, if it is there in the future, it's going to be dramatically attenuated.
Great. Well, Whitney, thank you very much for those thoughts. We're going to have another segment coming up in just a couple of minutes, folks. Please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market and your host, Michael McKay. We're going to continue this conversation of families and money right after the break. Please stay with us. Welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we've been talking with Whitney Wogan on families and money. We've covered a lot of topics today, Whitney. I'm sure we can talk about quite a few more. How can a family save when they're in debt?
Well, one of the things I talk about with the couples that I work with and the women that I work with is developing the habit of savings, and that initially I try and get people to realize that the habit is more important than the amount. So even if you start setting aside, if your focus is on paying down debt, which a lot of people are focused on right now, I think it's still important to get into the habit of setting aside a certain amount of money each month. And even if that's just $10, $20 in a shoebox or in an account, starting to create that habit, almost that energetic pathway, if you will, kind of opening that up so that you're starting to flow money back to yourself and pay yourself first. That habit's extremely important. Mm-hmm. And I think initially the habit's more important than the amount. A second thing is really getting clear on what your debts are. So making a list of all of your debts. What's the interest rate on all of those? What are you paying all those? And Megan, you brought up a good point at the break mm-hmm. about paying down credit card debt.
Yeah, Suze Orman, one of my favorite commentators on financial issues, has basically explained if you're going to strategically go about paying off your credit card debt, the best place to start is with the credit card that has the highest interest rate, not the highest balance, and paying that one off first, because the interest rate is what's costing you in the long run, looking at that long run. But Michael also made the point that, you know, you want to think about, you know, how much you're saving. And people do need to save as well as paying off their debt. They need to save a certain amount based on what their expenses are to have that safety net, but they also need to be gradually paying off their high-interest credit cards.
I really like what you just said also, Whitney, about making saving a habit is more important than the amount. Because that answers the question of, well, isn't it better to pay off debt than to save? Actually, you need to do both. Mm-hmm. And if you're paying off your debt and you have an extra $5, save it. You know, get into that habit. I know that's actually what helped me turn it around many years ago when I had to try to dig myself out of a hole after a second business failure. And I had to start saving, and I was able to scratch together about, I think it was about $25 a month. And that $25 a month became more because the habit kind of feeds itself. That's a very important point, I think.
Yeah, you start to see that the savings build, and then that's what reinforces it.
So let's talk about children for just a second. We don't have a lot of time left in the show, but what's the most important thing children need to learn about finances?
Hmm. I asked my daughters this question, a 13 and 15-year-old, and one of them said, budgeting, Mom, it's really important to learn how to budget. The other said, it's really important to learn how to make money, and which tells you a little bit about each of their personalities.
Mm-hmm.
But I gave it some good thought, and I think that it's that they need to, if you can somehow instill in your children that money is not scary, that it's not something to be frightened of or avoid, that it's actually something to be looked into, you will give your kids a tremendous benefit.
Wonderful ending comment. I love this. Let's end on this particular point, folks, that Whitney just made, that we want to see money not be scary, and let's get our kids trained in understanding and learning about money and finances. Between now and next week, folks, please come and visit us at radiofreemarket.com, and you can read more. And also go to Whitney's website, womenwithmoneymoxie.com. This is Michael McKay. You've been listening to radiofreemarket.com, and we will talk to you next week. Thank you very much for listening.